This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of, in this case, modern art, even a little ancient art, and definitely art forgery. Welcome to the show, everybody. I am Michael Shaw. This is episode 294 with Clay Small. He is a novelist, a law school professor. Yeah, talk about unusual for a guest for this show. But we do talk about art, including forgery, among other things. More on that in a bit. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see an image of what is perhaps the original reference in painting to golf, a painting called Boys Playing Golf on the Road from 1624. You can see Han von Meegeren in court prior to getting, I think, finally handed down a prosecution, and some Michael Jackson bubblegum cards. How is that for eclectic? So before I get to a little bit more of the description of this episode, I wanted to give you a couple of updates. We just had a virtual cafe yesterday as I record this. For those of you who wanted to be there but couldn't, hopefully we'll come to the next one. I don't know when that'll be. We spent some time talking about the future of the podcast, and I got some good feedback about that. So hopefully updates on that to come. We also talked a lot about, in the early part of the cafe, about Clubhouse, which I am now on because it has finally moved over to Android as well as just iPhone. If you're on Clubhouse already and you want to find me there, it's Michael Shaw hyphen pod is my username. So please go ahead and follow me, and maybe we will get together a room in the near future. That is in the works. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, Clubhouse is an app that's been around, I guess, for 6 months, maybe more. It's sort of a little bit like a live podcast type of thing in that there are people host rooms. You can go in them, listen to them, and participate in them, only audio-wise, not visually. But the rooms are basically conversations divided up into any imaginable topic. Certainly, we are focused on contemporary art. I heard about a couple of rooms in particular, one called Art with a colon symbol, not the word colon. Anyway, I don't have enough to go on just yet, but I am willing to give it a try. So hopefully those of you who are already on will get together with me and ultimately the podcast. And those of you who have not checked it out, be interested to see if you do. Okay, before we get again to the description of this episode, a few thank yous and whatnot. Thank you to those of you who made it to the virtual cafe and have been coming regularly. Much appreciated, and look forward to seeing you guys in the next one. Big thanks to Ali Widows and Van Cashinero for all of their numerous contributions. Thank you. Many thanks to those of you who are supporting the show on Patreon on a monthly basis. And if you value this podcast yourself and would like to support it, please go to theconversationpod.com/support, where you will find a number of ways that you can give to the show. And of course, you can also simply follow us for free on Instagram at Artist Podcast. You can follow me there, Michael Shaw Art. And lastly, if you would like to keep in touch or just support me as an artist, apart from being a podcaster, you can sign up for the email list that is on the newly designed website, michaelshawstudio.com, and entering in your email in the form at the bottom of the page. Thank you very much in advance for doing any number of those things. I appreciate it. Okay, so I connected with Clay Small, our guest today, because I was informed of his book called The Forger's Forgery, which he published recently, which is a novel about forgery, but it's based very much in a lot of research that he has done. So we talk a lot about art forgery, particularly art forgery of the 20th century, a little less so contemporary art forgery. And his focus has been on English and European forgers. So you'll learn a lot about that. The other thing that really hooked me in wanting to talk with Clay is that he was able to get a visit to what's called the Six Collection in Amsterdam, which is very hard to get into. You know, so anything around art entities that are very hard to get into kind of pricks up my ears. So he talks about how he got in there, mainly through this article he wrote about Dutch culture called It Must Be the Bikes, which you will find a link to on the episode page. And some careful finagling, he was able to sort of jump the line and get into the Six Collection, which he talks about in some detail. One of the things he saw there is that painting, the pre-Golf painting that I alluded to earlier. That is something we talk about. And if that's not enough, he also talks about working with the late Michael Jackson and getting a visit at his house in California, which, as you might imagine, was quite bizarre. So all of that coming up. Oh, I should also mention that Clay is currently a law professor. He teaches at SMU in Dallas, as well as a university in Barcelona, and then another in Amsterdam. That's one of the reasons that he spends a lot of time in Amsterdam. And so just to give you a little context, that is what he is doing. He teaches international law. And at the very end of our conversation, I asked for a little bit of clarity around defamation. And you can ask me why about that in private. Thank you very much for listening to the show. If you have any updates, if you have any feedback about the show, if you have any guests to recommend, definitely go to theconversationpod.com for all of that. Hope you guys are all vaxxed and, you know, kind of sneaking out there a little bit more and whatnot, feeling a little less constrained. I will talk to you in a couple of weeks if all goes according to plan. Until then, be well. Ciao for now. So, Clay, you wrote this article called It Must Be the Bikes. It Must Be the Bikes.
Must Be the Bikes.
Yeah, and so that was, it's on your website, but it was published on an English language, Dutch-based internet site?
Yes.
Got it.
Yes.
And so I read that. I just read that the other day. It was very interesting. And it's quite an image, that you paint of the chaos, the near chaos, I should say, the almost on the verge of constant chaos of the bikes. I assume this is more of a big city like an Amsterdam and Rotterdam and bigger cities. Is it all over the country, you think?
It's everywhere you go.
Right.
Everywhere you go.
Yeah.
And it's limited to certain times of the day. So at rush hour in the morning and the night is where you really see it. And there are unwritten, unknowable for other than the Dutch rules of the road about how you cross, how you pass, that are unfathomable and cause all the problems for the foreigners because they don't know when to cross the damn street.
Right. Right. Ultimately, your article is a tribute to the Dutch and their culture.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so
I would agree.
And so I mention all this because this was, according to what you told me before, the article that got you through the velvet rope of the Six. Why don't we use that as a sort of segue to talk about the Six? Can you, before we get back to the way that you were able, you're sort of got on the list. Could you introduce people to briefly, like sort of do a brief summary of the Six and the family and then the collection?
I can certainly do that.
Great.
Well, the Six Collection is named for the Six family, which have been living in Amsterdam since early in the 17th century. They have had a couple of different houses in Amsterdam, and their current house is directly across the Amstel River from the Hermitage, which is the Russian Art Museum.
Mm-hmm.
It is a four-story huge house with expansive backyard and is most famous for the fact that it holds the collection of art that the Six family has been accumulating for all these centuries. And not only art, but what I would describe as oddities. And for example, there are pig bladders in a display that held the oil paints that Rembrandt used to paint portraits.
Wow.
And the entire house is unique because of, I think, the walls and the ceilings. The ceilings, for instance, were moved from the original house on Herrengotch, and they took down these wooden squared ceilings and moved them in pieces to install in the new house on Amstel. So these ceilings are from the 17th century.
Hmm.
There are walls that are leather, and the leather has been stained gold, and these walls, wall coverings, also date from the 17th century. Wow. Throughout the house, there are incredible pieces of art. There are many portraits, four of which are by Rembrandt, of the Six family over the years. The most famous of these paintings is of Baron Six the First, which was, again, a Rembrandt portrait. And many experts would say that this is the most beautiful portrait that Rembrandt ever painted. And it sits in the dining room in the house, and across the floor from this incredible painting is, as I recall, a lamp that I'll never really be able to get out of my mind, because the lampshade, which was global, when you look closer, is a blown up blowfish.
Hmm.
And below that sits a 2,250-year-old Egyptian statue. And throughout the house, they have these antiquities and these paintings that are startling in the fact that they have been in the same family for all these years. And the house, which the Six family lives in, is open to the public as a result of a deal the family cut with the Dutch government, that if they opened the house to the public, they would not have to pay estate taxes as every generation turned. And why is this important? Well, it's important because the Six family had to sell some unbelievable paintings, including Vermeer's Milkmaid, to pay estate taxes.
Mm.
This way, they can maintain all the art they have, and they get security protection from the government for that art in return for opening up the house on an extremely limited basis to 10 people on Thursdays at 11 o'clock.
Mm. Now, before we get more into your visit and how that happened, let's back up for a second. What is the source of the Six family's wealth originally and over the years?
Well, a couple of things. First, they were in the manufacturing business, and they manufactured mostly clothes, but they also manufactured some equipment. And the family moved to Amsterdam in order to expand their business.
Mm-hmm.
Second, they managed to marry extremely well over the years.
Hmm.
And brought in not only wealth to the family, but brought in remarkable collections of art to combine with the ones they already had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, do you think there was any inbreeding?
I don't know. I see no signs of it, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There are, again, these portraits of all the barons over the years and their wives, and so there's nothing to think that that would be a problem.
Okay. So meanwhile, back to the article that you wrote about the Dutch culture and bikes and whatnot. Wasn't
yes.
it that got you on the radar of the current sort of decision maker?
Yes, and that is the Baron himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I had heard about the Six collection, and I was really very dead set to get a look at it. And everybody I asked at the university level, some of them art professors, everyone basically told me good luck.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was on a lottery basis, and that you just you had to wait in line, and it was a very long line. So I decided to take matters into my own hands, and I wrote a letter to the Baron. And in the letter, I attached a copy of this article I had written about It Must Be the Bikes, and explained to him that I had been to Amsterdam over 20 times, had done a lot of financial work with the Dutch government, and was at that point a visiting professor at BU University. Mm-hmm. And that because of all that, maybe he would consider me as someone who would get a pass from the lottery system and be allowed to see the collection. Mm-hmm. And my letter went unanswered for months. I had basically given up when one day I got an email telling me exactly what day I had to be there, exactly what time I had to be there. I could take nothing in with me, can take no photographs, and making it very clear that this was a personal invitation and I was to bring no one with me.
Mm. Was it a time when you were going to be in Amsterdam anyway, or did you have to make a special trip?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you ask. I did have to make a special trip.
Yeah.
That I ended up being able to reset my teaching schedule at VU so that everything synced up.
Right.
It all worked out just fine.
That's great. Can you clarify? VU sounds a lot like BU in the States. Do you want to clarify what VU is?
It means the word is Vrije, and it means free university. It's no longer free. It had the reason it is called, was called, and is called the free university is because it had no religious connections.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of the three large universities in Amsterdam.
Uh-huh. And what are your students like?
My students are very unique because they truly are all from all over the world.
Mm.
When I teach in the United States, I have never had a Russian student, for instance.
Yeah.
And when I'm in Amsterdam, I always have Russian students.
Mm-hmm.
And my students in the United States are undergraduates. And in Amsterdam, they are lawyers trying to get their master's in international law. So they're much more mature. They're obviously older, and they're very intent on learning.
Right.
This is not a social experiment for them. This is their future. They tend to be very on top of their studies.
And are you?
They also. I'm sorry. Go
ahead. I was going to just say, are you teaching international law? Is that your primary subject?
What I basically teach there is about American laws that have extraterritorial effect, laws that can affect them as they practice law around the world, things like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, things like Sarbanes-Oxley, things that can catch people who are practicing in foreign jurisdictions with some nexus to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Does any of your content or your syllabi cover shell corporations and whatnot?
Well, yes, actually, there's one lecture that I do on Enron, who, of course, were notorious for using off-balance sheet shell corporations. But other than that, no.
Okay, got it. Okay, thank you for bringing us up to speed on the university and the teaching that you're doing. So back to your entry to the six. So you got in. You got that special appointment.
Yes.
Talk about your fellow six collection goers and a little more about that experience, please.
Other than me, it was a homogeneous group. We all were put in an ante room where there was a sign-in book, which was a quill pen, and everyone signed in, and I will confess I took a look at some of the prior pages, and there was nothing but Dutch names.
Mm.
There were 10 of us. The other nine were middle-aged to elderly Dutch people.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly they knew I wasn't Dutch. I think they knew I wasn't Dutch, especially when the docent who was this wonderful young lady with bright blue hair, asked if the group wanted to proceed in Dutch or English, and there was only one voice that said English. And, of course, everybody in Holland speaks English, so it wasn't really material to them, but there was no question that I was not one of them.
Right. Was the rest of the group, would you say, consistently of a particular class, or was it not that clear?
That's not clear to me. It's hard to tell. And the Dutch all kind of dress alike. So it's hard to tell, you know, who's from what strata of society. And the women all dress very well, very stylishly, whatever their age. And the men tend to dress as plainly as humanly possible.
Right.
And that was that group.
Right. Did you end up – now, I know you've made it pretty clear, and I think you did last time when we spoke, that you were, you know, the the pea that did not fit into the larger pod. But did you have any conversations with them? Like, did they want to know – did anybody want to know how did you get in here?
Yes. Again, the women wanted to know. The men couldn't have cared less. But I got into discussion with the three of the women, and they thought it was the Dutch loved the word nice, and I must have heard that word nice, you know, 10 times in 30 seconds from them.
Uh-huh.
That's so nice for you. It's so nice that you come here. Isn't this a nice collection?
Huh.
They were interested, and I didn't feel any kind of resentment from them. But they were clearly interested in what was I doing there.
Yeah, got it. So talk a little bit more about the work you saw when we spoke before. You mentioned one painting in particular that has a very has huge cultural import, at least sports-wise.
Yes. The Dutch people as a whole are incredibly modest. And they have this one interesting trait, which is they take credit for inventing a huge number of things. They take credit, for instance, for creating the stock market. They take credit for creating the zoo. And they take credit for international trade. And one of the things that's always amused me over the years is they take credit for inventing golf. And there is a painting on the second floor with three children with, it looks like, their mother maybe. And two of the children have sticks that to me look like polo sticks. Is that what you call polo sticks? I don't know, maybe it's polo clubs. And it's a round ball that is the size of a baseball. And the name of the painting is The Game of Golf, and it was painted in 1624, and that clearly precedes the Scottish invention of golf.
Right.
Now, were these kids getting ready to play ice hockey? Were they getting ready to play some form of baseball? What were they getting ready to do? But the Dutch claim it was golf, and that they invented golf. And by the way, the Dutch have beautiful golf courses on the North Sea. Under the painting, all it says is in Dutch, The Game of Golf.
Great. So anything, any other works that you remember? Because again, you know, and we talked about this before, I asked you if you had a semi-photographic memory, but basically, as you told me, when you got out of there, you went right back to your place and wrote a 10 pages of notes on what you saw. What other things stood out to you from your notes?
There was a painting by Rembrandt of one of the six wives, which has a very almost black background, and she has a collar that is round and very complex around her neck. And it's not a happy painting. It's kind of a solemn painting. But because the background is so dark, her face stands out like nothing I've ever seen in a painting before. Mm-hmm. And the docent told us something interesting about how Rembrandt painted these elaborate Dutch collars from the 17th century. And you would think what he did was, on a black background, he would paint in the white of the collar, but he did just the opposite. He would make the background white and paint in the black. And that really stuck with me. And so I started looking at all these collars on all these portraits and wondering why they would do it that way. And you know, again, I am not an artist, so I don't know. But according to the docent, that's how they did it.
So in addition to the sixth collection, you, going back before the sixth collection visit, I should say, you have had a an investment and an interest in the Netherlands in terms of its art, and that mainly has to do with the history of forgery. And in fact, you have a book that came out fairly recently, The Forger's Forgery, right? So why don't you talk just a little bit about the origin of your interest in this, or what became an obsession of this particular subject in art?
Well, it started with my first trip to the Netherlands. My local council there took me to lunch at the Rijksmuseum. And I think before that, I was aware that there was this artist called Vermeer. And when I saw his paintings in the Rijksmuseum, two of which were Little Street and the other was The Milkmaid, I was absolutely taken by these paintings. And that started me going to various museums, again, around the world, whenever I had the chance, to see as many Vermeers as I could. And I started reading about Vermeer, who I found fascinating, because he died having, I think it was 14 children. He was in his 30s when he died, and he only left behind 35 known paintings, and he died absolutely broke. And yet somehow he is the artist that the man on the street and the art connoisseur all agree was a great artist. So I started doing this thing with going to these museums. And in The Hague, for instance, is a museum that has The Girl with the Pearl Earring. And then I heard about this guy named Han van Meegeren, who was a very accomplished artist in his own right, but decided to turn to forgery and started in the 1940s forging Vermeers in addition to a variety of other 17th century Dutch Renaissance artists. And Van Meegeren became the single richest artist of his time. And he was a man who owned 60 different properties in Amsterdam that he had bought using the wealth that was derived from his forgeries. So I became very interested in how this guy could have accumulated such wealth and pulled the wool over so many eyes. And so I started investigating Van Meegeren, reading about him and about his techniques and how he pulled the wool over so many people's eyes. And that eventually led to the book, The Forger's Forgery.
And in the process, it seems like, you know, having seen your book presentation, you know, and Q&A with the Dallas bookstore, virtually, that is, it seems like you're a bit of an expert on forgery. I mean, there's part of your research and work, I assume, is looking into the study of forgery. So, you know, where do you place yourself in terms of expertise with the professionals who do that kind of thing?
Well, again, that is not my profession. I am a professor and a novel writer, so I look at it from that perspective. But what has fascinated me about forgery is the world's view of forgers.
Right.
the world doesn't view forgers as the felons that they clearly are, but as clever rascals who are somehow ensnarled in a bit of sophomoric tomfoolery.
Right.
And it's basically a boys will be boys kind of a situation where we don't really want to punish these guys, despite the fact that they have sold and profited from selling fake art. And it's also interesting that there are no female forgers.
Hmm.
There are only men.
Mm-hmm.
And why in the world is that?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't answer that question. But to me, the interesting part is that there are example after example of these forgers who are very flamboyant guys, very amusing, very smart, and the world chooses to turn a blind eye on their crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened in the case of Van Meegeren as well.
Mm-hmm. There was a documentary about, I'm sure there have been many, but I apologize for not remembering which forger, but there was a documentary maybe five-ish years ago about, I think, a U.S.-based forger who was kind of socially awkward and kept to himself. Do you know the forger I'm referring to by any chance?
Let me think about that for a second. No, I don't, because the forgers that I have spent most of my time looking at have all been either English or European.
Okay, got it.
Recent forgery involving one of the most famous galleries in New York City, and the forger operated out of Flushing, New York, but he was of Chinese descent and went back to China to avoid prosecution.
Was that the Knoedler Gallery?
Yep.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Got it. Good. Okay. So this culture, I think it probably applies to this artist who I will have to see if I can look up later, or I should say the forger. I should have to look up later, who also was kind of put into that category of boys will be boys / tomfoolery. It is a funny phenomenon. And I thought, when I first heard you talk about it, before we got to the Q&A, when you seemed to be much more sort of live and let live about the whole thing, I initially thought when you talked, the way you talked about it, that you kind of wanted some blood for these people. Where do you land right now when it comes to, you know, that this is all in good fun, you know, as the hosts from the bookstore said, no harm, no foul. You know, where do you land today when it comes to all of that?
Well, there are those who say that these forgeries are so well done, they are such great pieces of art, that who cares?
Mm-hmm.
And there's part of me that feels that way. But there's part of me that also analyzes it from a legal perspective. For instance, there's this thing called RICO here in the United States, which is the Racketeering Influenced Organizations Act, which basically is used to prosecute crimes that are conducted by multiple people in an organizational fashion. Well, these forgers are all in violation of RICO.
Mm-hmm.
They're square on violations. So part of me says, well, how come we're prosecuting these other folks for RICO violations and we somehow don't go after the forgers?
Mm-hmm.
And that's my problem. There seems to be some unequal application of justice.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, these forgers tend to be so clever and tend to be such likable people that is part of me that says, okay, so what? Let bygones be bygones.
Mm.
And I, you know, we one of the examples I used was when they unmasked these Max Ernst forgeries. One of the Max Ernst forgeries was purchased for $17 million.
Mm.
And when the owner was told about that, he said, I don't really care because this is the best Max Ernst I've ever seen. So there's part of you that does say that. And then there's another part of you that says, can you imagine being the curator of a museum when a certain artist comes under suspicion of having been forged?
Yeah.
And you know you're looking at one of the ones on the wall, and you've never been all that certain about its provenance.
Yeah.
And do you really want to know if it's a forgery?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not. So there's a lot of different points of view on this.
Right. And to take this one example of the Knoedler gallery, the art,
yep.
I think it was more than one, right? It was at least a couple of different knockoffs. That forger fled.
Oh no, there were 70. There were 72 of them.
Oh wow. Okay. Well, not just a couple, dozens. So yep. That forger fled to avoid prosecution. So is that where we are? Do you think generally with contemporary forgers that they know that they're going to get heavy sentences or are likely to, and so they're going to do whatever they can to get out of that situation?
Yes. I think that as we go forward and art has become such a huge multi-billion dollar business, and there's so many people that have major stakes in the need for authenticity, that those in the future who are caught will probably not be able to escape as those in the past have. And as the price of art goes up, the tendency for forgery goes up. But at the same time, people's concern about authenticity also goes up. And I think there will be prosecutions in the future.
Mm-hmm. And I know, that, again, this is not your expertise, but you do believe that there is forgery with contemporary art going on.
I think there's no question about it.
Do you have any specific examples?
Well, the experts in the field will say that between 20% and 40% of art in private collections and museums is forgery.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you go about proving that if the museums and the collectors are unwilling to play ball?
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you're the curator,
right,
and you think you've got a Modigliani that may be a forgery, do you really want that proven out?
Yeah.
Or wouldn't you rather just sit there and say, it's a Modigliani, and let people look at it?
Mm-hmm.
So the impetus to do this, by the way, the investigatory branch of the government is in the FBI that looks into forgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And they have not been terribly active.
Right.
They, when called, will respond, but they're not out there investigating on a daily basis.
It's not a hot enough issue for them probably to have at the top of their list a lot of the time.
No, I mean, it's not terrorism.
No.
It's not violence.
Right.
It's not money laundering.
Right.
Although it is kind of money laundering.
It is, right.
So there's no interest.
Interesting. And so let's talk just a little bit about your book. I will, full disclosure, I haven't read it. Apologies for that. But are you interested in catering to an art audience, or is it aimed in any way at art aficionados, or not necessarily?
I think that people that have an interest in art will find the book extremely educational about what Van Meegeren did.
Mm-hmm.
And how I do that is there is a character who is a art professor at the University of Amsterdam who lectures on Van Meegeren. And through those lectures and through her book presentations later, you learn a lot about how Van Meegeren did this.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you just like one example.
Okay.
He figured out a technological breakthrough for forgery. In the early 20th century to the mid-20th century almost, there was a very certain test to use on oil paintings to see if they were new or they had aged for centuries. And it was so simple. You take a piece of cotton swath and put alcohol on it. And if you rub it on the painting, slight amounts of oil will come off.
Mm-hmm.
And Van Meegeren figured out that if you take certain plastics, you mix them with the paints, and then bake the final painting, it eliminates the test with alcohol and cotton.
Mm.
So this was a major technological breakthrough to put off those who are inspecting the painting that had an easy test to demonstrate the age.
Right. So that raises an interesting sort of thought experiment. Van Meegeren could have certainly become an expert in conservation. He could have become an expert in consulting with artists around techniques and, you know, and whatnot and so on. But
yeah,
he chose this route. I wonder if that route chose him, you know, if all sort of gravity led him into becoming a forger, or, you know, and or if you see him, since you have studied him quite a bit, as sort of inherently on the dark side, for lack of a better term. I didn't want to call him evil per se.
No, he definitely lived on the dark side,
right,
his entire life.
Right.
And he was, again, an accomplished artist in his own right.
Mm-hmm.
There was one pencil drawing he did of the Dutch princess's fawn that was in one out of every, 25% of every household in the Netherlands had a replica of this drawing.
Mm.
That's how popular it was.
Mm.
He then did an exhibit in The Hague, a one-man show at the Blessing Gallery, which got panned by the critics.
Mm.
And the critics said he was out of touch with time because all his paintings had a religious connotation.
Hmm.
And modernism was coming into the forefront, and they dismissed him as being technically proficient but having little heart.
Hmm.
And it just threw him for a loop. And then is when he turned to forgery. And part of it was obviously money, but I think the other part was to stick it to these supposed know-it-alls who dismissed his art but couldn't even tell the difference between a true Vermeer and one of the Vermeers that he himself had done.
Right.
So there's a revenge factor that's pretty salient.
I see. Interesting. Huh. Do you have anybody analogous on your radar currently that you're starting to get interested in, or are you still generally historical in your interest currently?
Well, it's historical for me because, forgers don't become something you can research until they're caught.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, I can't wait for the next one to be caught. And, you know, there's always stories. There's a story just 2 weeks ago about one poor little French museum in a little French town who prided itself on its collection of this one artist. And just, you know, a month ago, it was proven that 80% of those paintings by this one artist were forgeries.
Mm.
So it continues to happen. They continue to be exposed. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to the next one.
The artist who was involved in all the multiple paintings that Knoedler was in possession of fled, as you said, to avoid prosecution back to Asia. was it?
To China.
To China?
He's in China. He's in Shanghai.
Okay. What do you know what his what the latest on him in doing in Shanghai is?
He lives in a very quiet life.
Mm-hmm.
He's an older man now.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, he paints under his own name.
Huh. And do you think is there any sense that he's profiting on his notoriety?
No, I see none of that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the information, because we're in Shanghai, China, so the information is going to be very limited.
Right.
That's going to come out of there.
Right.
But no, he seems to be living a very quiet life. He lives in a third floor walk-up apartment,
mm-hmm,
with his wife,
mm-hmm,
and he has a studio in the back where he paints.
Interesting. Huh. I want to ask you, if you don't mind, you can always say no, about your... So prior to your teaching law, you were a lawyer. You were general counsel at PepsiCo, right, for several decades.
Yes.
What kind of reactions have you gotten from being that you're somebody that from time to time travels around artists, or art types? What kind of feedback, if any, do you recall getting, you know, when they learn that about you, if you don't mind my asking?
I don't feel any negative feedback.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be interested that I would take an interest in art at this level,
mm-hmm,
rather than just visiting museums and commenting on the art.
Right.
Being willing to kind of roll up my sleeves and research it. They seem to be very positive about that.
Mm-hmm. What was, could you, I mean, it's obviously to boil down, you know, that kind of career down to a short summary is obviously probably a tricky proposition, but what were the kinds of campaigns or, you know, negotiations or projects, if you will, you can rephrase however you like, that you typically worked on during that career?
Well, I was a lawyer for almost 40 years, so there's a lot of ground to cover, but probably the most colorful one and the one people still talk about was my negotiations with Michael Jackson.
Mm.
Do you want to hear about that?
Was this when you were working for PepsiCo?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What led you to working on negotiations with Michael Jackson? Oh, right. Because he was selling Pepsi.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. And he had an accident as well.
Pardon me?
He had an accident as well.
Oh, yes. That's what kind of started the whole thing.
Okay. All right. Yes, please. Please.
Well, the first contract we did with him was with him and his brothers. It was going to be the final Jackson's tour.
Mm-hmm.
And the day BBDO, our advertising firm, was filming the ad, there was a lot of pyrotechnics being used around the stage. Michael was fighting with one of his brothers. I think it was Jermaine. I can't remember anymore. And stepped onto the platform too early. He was supposed to go up on a platform and all the brothers would follow him. He stepped off too early. And the fireworks went off, hit his head that had a lot of pomade in it, and it went on fire. And obviously that soured our relationship somewhat. And a couple of years later, we got a call saying that Michael would like to talk. And so Roger Enrico, who was then president of Pepsi-Cola, and myself, got on our plane and flew out to California. And we went for dinner at Michael's house. And we were sitting around the table with his manager, a guy named DeLeo, who was absolutely the absolute character of a Hollywood mogul type, cigar stuck in his mouth the entire time, even when he ate. And a real potty mouth. And he, Michael, told us we were going to have yogurt, tea, and ookies for dinner. And ookies are, I came to learn, cookies without sugar.
Huh.
A woman arrives with this huge urn, and she is wrapped head to foot in gauze, completely wrapped. So all you can see is a little hole for her mouth and a hole for her eyes and nose.
Wow.
And she takes this urn and pours it into these little cups at the table. And that was the yogurt tea. And then we had these ookie cookies.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sitting around the table, and Roger says, okay, Michael, you know, what do you want to do? We're here to back you if you want to go out on the road. And you, let's get our relationship back to where it was. And so Michael, you know, he had, at this point in time, he was probably the most famous person in the world, and he hadn't started all this. He's had some cosmetic surgery, but he looked normal.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very, very shy, whisper voice that he spoke in.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he was ready to go on the road with his new band. And he said, and this time we're going to set the world on fire. And he reaches up and touches his head. And I was the only one at the table who laughed. And I got a bad look from Roger. But I kind of bonded with Michael then, because then he and I looked at each other. We both gave each other a knowing look. And then he says, do you want to go to my bedroom and watch TV? And I say, sure. So up we go. Roger went with us too. And he had this enormous bedroom around which were 12 mannequins of every color of the rainbow. And they were in various states of undress.
Mm.
And it was quite clear to me that he spoke to these mannequins.
Mm.
And in the middle of the room was a cage with what looked like this very hairy two-year-old who had Oshkosh jeans on and a plaid shirt, and it was his monkey, Bubbles.
Mm.
So we settled down on a couch to watch a John Wayne movie, and it was Michael, me, the monkey, and Roger. And we watched this movie for about an hour and a half. I can remember saying to myself, I wonder what my father would think after paying all those bills for all my education. I'm sitting here with a monkey watching John Wayne. So then we went for a tour of his house, and it was pretty amazing. He had this garage. Every car was exactly the same in that it was a white convertible, but there were Jaguars, Rolls Royces, Bentleys, BMWs, you name it. But they were all white convertibles.
Hmm.
And I said, Michael, do you drive these cars? He said, no, just this one. And it was a white rabbit. We then went to visit his zoo, which was an amazing experience as well. And we ended up in his private movie theater, which sat about 50 people in these plush red seats. And outside, there was this huge candy counter with every kind of candy you've ever heard of.
Right.
And there was these bubblegum packs of Michael Jackson cards. And so I said, you know, Michael, I have three children. Would you mind if I brought some for them? And he goes, oh, yes. Exactly what they're there for. And so we went back to the hotel. Roger left, and I spent the next, I don't know, 4 days dealing with his attorneys and Michael and getting the contract together. And I never heard anything from him again until one day that summer, a package arrived, and it was three signed photographs of Michael and tickets to his Madison Square Garden concert.
Hmm.
He was just the sweetest guy, and it was his way of saying thanks for working things out on the deal.
Huh. to fully contextualize this, though, prior to your working with his lawyer team to negotiate this contract, was there a lawsuit out of the?
Yes.
Okay, and were you on the defense side or?
I was.
Okay, how did
I
that?
Definitely was.
How did that go?
We settled it by making a. I got to be careful here. A large donation to a burn unit at an LA hospital whose name I can't now recall.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that settled the lawsuit. And once we settled the lawsuit, that's when he called and asked to have the meeting.
Mm. Interesting. When you teach your classes, whether at SMU here in the States or in Barcelona or in Amsterdam, does any of this come up or any of your other PepsiCo colorful stories come up?
Well, especially at SMU where I'm teaching juniors and seniors in college.
Right.
I try to bring in as many real-life incidents, real-life problems that illustrate a point of law that we're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, when I talk about Sarbanes-Oxley, which I don't want to get into a bunch of legal mumbo-jumbo, which basically is how board of directors have come to be governed, I spend time talking about the collapse of Enron and my meetings with those Enron executives that preceded the collapse when they wanted us to do a deal with them on energy.
Mm.
So I go through those kind of scenarios to give context to the legal principles that they are learning.
Right. Do some of the juniors and seniors maybe not even know who Michael Jackson is, do you think, at this point?
No, they all know.
Okay.
It's interesting. They all know.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I talk about when I get to defamation, I talk about Britney Spears and her defamation cases. If you can bring it to something that is in their realm, is something that they are interested in and somehow apply the legal principle to that, it has a lot more staying power.
Right. Let me ask you, if you don't mind, as a very bizarre way to wrap up, a selfish question around defamation, because okay. My understanding as a podcaster is that I can say what my experience is. Can you just maybe briefly sort of summarize what I am legally entitled to say before I get into defamation territory?
Well, the two main defenses in any kind of defamation case are truth, and that is illustrated by the great Oscar Wilde case, and opinion. If something is simply your opinion and you don't surround that opinion with significant facts, then it is not defamation.
Hmm.
Now, defamation in this country has become very confused because of a thing called the Communications Decency Act, which gave the internet a different pass on defamation than the rest of us get. If a newspaper, if a podcast, if a radio show, if a television show repeat a defamatory statement, they are equally as liable as the original issuer.
Mm.
That is not true on the internet.
Mm.
And so it's very confusing. And there's a lot of focus now on whether that pass for defamation should continue.
Mm. Got it. Well, Clay, this has been a very entertaining and interesting ride. Thank you very much for talking to me.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Michael. And let me know if you want to talk more about defamation sometime.
I definitely will, actually, right after we end this recording. And we're out.